The New Statesman.
Before we begin, we wanted to be as transparent as possible about how we have produced this episode, which has been paid for by Philip Morris International. The New Statesman retained full editorial control of the episode. As is normal with many podcast interviews, our guest, Dr. Moira Gilchrist, an employee of PMI, took part in a briefing call prior to recording where we shared the broad topics we wanted to cover so she could prepare for the interview. However, we did not share questions in advance. It was also agreed in advance that although PMI are paying for the episode, no question is off limits. PMI have been allowed to hear a preview of the episode for fact-checking, but they have not changed any of the editorial content. Most importantly, we want to hear from you about our partnered podcast in general and this discussion in particular. Please do get in touch with us to share your views. You can email podcasts@newstatesman.co.uk. And now to the episode. Can Rishi Sunak succeed in creating a smoke-free generation? I'm Becky Slack, and this is a special episode of the New Statesman podcast. In March this year, the government introduced the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, which aims to create the first smoke-free generation by banning the sale of tobacco products to anyone born after the 1st of January 2009. It's a flagship policy for Rishi Sunak, who first announced it with much fanfare in his speech at the Conservative Party conference in October.
Smoking causes 1 in 4 cancer deaths. It kills 64,000 people a year and leads to almost 1 hospital admission every minute. I propose that in future, we raise the smoking age by 1 year every year. That means a 14-year-old... That means a 14-year-old today will never legally be sold a cigarette, and that they and their generation can grow up smoke-free.
MPs have voted to back the government's plans, and the bill is now through to committee stage, with support from Labour, who, it should be said, proposed a progressive smoking ban more than a year ago. Can it work? Is it possible for the UK to go smoke-free? And does proposed legislation on vapes and tobacco alternatives go far enough? Dr. Moira Gilchrist is a pharmaceutical scientist and the Chief Communications Officer for Philip Morris International, the firm behind Marlboro Cigarettes, whose slogan is now Delivering a Smoke-Free Future. She joins me via video call. Moira, welcome.
Thank you very much, Becky. A pleasure to be here.
Moira, let's address the elephant in the room first. Some listeners will find it difficult to listen to the representative of a tobacco company like PMI, which helped create the problem we are discussing, talking about how to phase out smoking, especially in a discussion sponsored by that company. What do you say to those listeners? Do they have a point?
So first of all, I'm very respectful of the emotion that comes with this debate about smoking and how to end it. Very respectful. I started my career in the healthcare area and I'm fully aware of the dangers of smoking. But I chose a path that perhaps is a non-obvious one to try and solve the problem of smoking. And that was to join a company that I could see more than 18 years ago was interested in creating viable solutions that could contribute to reducing the health impact of cigarettes. So that's a path I chose. And all I ask listeners to do now is listen to the evidence and listen to the progress that we've made and make their minds up based on that and not necessarily the perception of the history of an industry that, frankly, in my company, I can only talk for my company, has changed incredibly since they may have last thought about it.
I think we might come on to the history of PMI a little later, but for now, you represent a company which makes huge profits from the sale of tobacco. Why now do you claim to be in favour of a smoke-free future?
It's not just now. In fact, this is a business strategy that we have been following for more than a decade now. So I joined the company 18 years ago to start what we now call our smoke-free transformation. We didn't know quite the magnitude that it would take at the time. But I came from the pharma industry to set up the R&D facility to be ready for the development and scientific assessment of what we now call smoke-free alternatives. So this has been long in the making. It took us a while to get everything in place, to get the design of the products in place, to get the scientific assessment process ongoing. But we really started on that journey in earnest, I would say, in round about 2014-15 timeframe, when we put the first products on the market in Japan and in Italy, on a small scale at first, but then very quickly realized that not only was the science extremely promising, but also that adult smokers were very interested in the product. So that really unlocked a different type of thinking for our company, which was, okay, cigarettes were our past, but could these smoke-free alternatives be our future? And we did a lot of thinking, a lot of analysis, and decided in 2016 to announce that we were going smoke-free. So that would be the business strategy for the future. So it's not something new. It's not a 2024 thing, but I think perhaps people haven't noticed the transformation that we have gone on, certainly in the last 10 years.
You talk about having done this for more than a decade, and yet it was in 2015 that PMI tried to sue the UK government over the last big change to tobacco regulations. That doesn't seem like the action of a company that wants to go smoke-free.
So as I mentioned in the time frame, that was around about the time where we were not yet certain what the future business strategy would be. Would we do that again? I'm not sure we would. We're focused fully on ensuring that we are bringing these new products because they don't deliver the toxic mix of chemicals that cigarette smoke does. So we made a decision, as I said, in 2016 to make that the future of our business. We welcome strict regulation on combustible cigarettes. It's the right thing to do to discourage people from smoking. But what we would also like to see is governments encouraging those adults who continue to smoke to learn about these new alternatives, to try them and to switch to them and switch completely rather than continuing to smoke.
Okay, so for the benefit of listeners, can you explain what is the difference between vapes, heated tobacco, e-cigarettes?
Sure. So technologically, they're quite different, but in terms of the scientific output, if you like, they're quite similar. So if I take vapes or e-cigarettes first, these are a liquid mixture that contains things like glycerin, some water and some flavors and nicotine. And that mixture is heated to produce a vapor, which then the user will inhale as you would do a cigarette. And the available data, including government data, shows that the level of harmful and potentially harmful chemicals in the aerosol or vapor from one of these products is significantly reduced compared to combustible cigarettes. Now, the advantage of that is that you're likely to see reduced risk in terms of diseases at a later stage. But one of the disadvantages of this type of product category is it's quite a different experience for a smoker compared to cigarettes. And that's where a category, for example, like heated tobacco products come in. So this category takes regular tobacco, which is processed in a different way to cigarettes, but then instead of burning the tobacco, which is the cause of the production of the vast majority of the harmful chemicals that end up in smoke, these products heat it at a temperature below the level where it will combust. And the result is, again, a very significant reduction in the production of the harmful chemicals that are associated with smoking-related diseases.
Can I just pick up on that slightly? So I've seen a study published in the ERJ Open Research Journal in 2019 that suggests that heated tobacco devices are, and I quote, no less toxic to human lung cells than ordinary cigarette smoke. How would you respond to that?
So I don't know the details on that particular study, but I can tell you what, for example, the US FDA looked at and the decision they made. So we submitted a dossier of evidence to the FDA in 2016 that contained 1 million pages of evidence going from smoke chemistry, aerosol chemistry, through to toxicological studies, looking at the impact on cells, through to clinical studies in adults who smoke, and also behavioral studies. The US FDA took about 3 years to look at the evidence. They combed through it in great detail and also independent evidence as well, and came to the conclusion that switching completely to our lead heated tobacco product significantly reduces exposure to harmful and potentially harmful chemicals. In terms of public health, I think that's a real advantage and an additional benefit along with vaping. Now, none of these products, Becky, are risk-free. I have to be super clear about that. These are not for people who don't smoke. They're addictive, they contain nicotine, and they're an adult choice and designed to be for adults who currently smoke.
haven't we been here before? I mean, light cigarettes were once marketed as being a healthier, less harmful alternative to regular cigarettes, and then they were found to be just as harmful. Indeed, as far as I understand it, it was this marketing around light cigarettes that formed part of the case by the US government when they successfully sued Philip Morris for having deceived the public about the health effects of cigarettes.
So first of all, Philip Morris International was not a party to the case that you mentioned there. That was the US company. It was a completely separate company from us. But nevertheless, let's talk about what you described, the light cigarettes. So if when light cigarettes had been introduced, we'd had the scientific tools that we have today, it would have been crystal clear that these products, those cigarettes were no better than any other cigarette. It would have been crystal clear, but the science was not available. If you fast forward a few decades, we have scientific tools and techniques that can clearly show whether a product is better than cigarette smoke or not. And that's the approach we took, was to produce high quality evidence that regulators, the public health community, and ultimately adult smokers could trust in order to inform their decision making about what they want to do next. So this is a completely different scientific construct that we're in today because of advances in science and technology. We're able to say much more about the potential impact of these products than ever before.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about trust, but the tobacco industry doesn't exactly have a particularly good record when it comes to telling the truth about tobacco. For years, your sector has refuted scientific evidence proving the links between smoking and cancer, even funding your own bad science. Why should New Statesman listeners take what you're telling them on face value?
I'm not asking anybody to take anything on face value. And I think we've done, I personally think, a very good job of making the evidence publicly available. So we're subjecting ourselves deliberately to scrutiny. We understand that we're entering this debate with a deficit of trust, and you can't ask people to trust you. You just have to give them evidence to make up their own minds. So it's been described by some people as a strategy of aggressive transparency. So we have a website that's got all of our scientific publications on it, for example. The FDA application, all million pages are publicly available for people to scrutinize. We've made the source data for many of our studies publicly available so people can analyze it for themselves and come to their own conclusion. And we did this very deliberately because we want people to make up their minds based on the evidence and not their opinion of us as a company.
Okay, let's bring the conversation back to the tobacco and vapes bill. Do you support the government's bill?
So I think the way I would describe it is there's certainly no way Philip Morris International is trying to get in the way of the bill. But I think if I look at the data, again, want to be evidence-led, the bill doesn't solve the problem that exists today. The younger generations that this bill is aimed to address are pretty much already almost smoke-free. And I think some analysis that we did showed that in these younger cohorts, they're likely to be smoke-free anyway about a year after the bill comes into effect. But nevertheless, if that's something that the government chooses to do, it's entirely, of course, in their purview. But what about all the adults today that already smoke? There's nothing in the bill for them. And that, I think, is a wasted opportunity. If some political capital and emotion and thinking had gone into the bill to provide something that helps solve the problem for those people, then I think we'd be in a position to get to a smoke-free society in the United Kingdom at a much greater speed and potentially within the next 10 to 15 years for all age cohorts, not just younger generations.
You said that you weren't getting in the way of the bill. So does this mean that PMI wasn't one of the tobacco companies that were lobbying MPs to vote against it?
So look, we make our opinions known to policymakers, regulators all around the world, and there's nothing to be ashamed of about that. It's important. We have important evidence, science, etc., that policymakers need to know about. And I think we have views about the bill, particularly because it conflates cigarettes with heated tobacco products, which goes against the evidence that's available and has the potential to cause confusion among adult smokers about what could be a better choice. So I think that's something that we felt quite strongly about. And I think, again, diverting a bit of energy and thought into what's the impact on current adult smokers is definitely something that politicians should be doing today.
Health campaigners have proposed that the tobacco industry should have a levy placed on their combustible business, which would cap profits and provide revenue to initiatives that aim to reduce smoking. Would PMI support a measure like that?
So we're open to discussions with all sorts of stakeholders about measures that can accelerate the end of smoking. Completely happy to engage with anybody who wants to have that type of serious discussion. But I think these discussions need to cover the full gamut of potential options that could be put on the table. So things like informing adult smokers about these alternatives that exist, that can we have education campaigns for the most hard to reach smokers to help them understand that quitting is the best option, but if they don't quit, that they should consider alternatives rather than continuing to smoke. You can look at all sorts of supply and demand measures that can accelerate the end of smoking. So I would welcome a debate with each and every stakeholder who wants to discuss the ideas that we have.
There's been a lot of focus on the role of vapes and heated tobacco products in helping people to stop smoking. I'd like to talk a minute or two about those products being a gateway to smoking. I've seen data from the European Commission published in 2021 that says there's moderate evidence that young people who use e-cigarettes and vapes are at a greater risk of starting to use cigarettes than those who don't. Similar data from ASH and other campaigners. So talk to me about that. I mean, you talk about wanting to create a smoke-free world, but isn't the reality that these products are actually going to result in even more people smoking?
I'm aware of some of the data and some of the opinions of some public health groups on this, but I think we have to look at what does the real world data show. If it were true that these products were acting as a gateway to smoking, you would expect to see increases in smoking rates among populations who are using these new products like vapes and heated tobacco products. In fact, the real world data shows that the opposite is true. If we take Japan as an example, where heated tobacco products are pretty prevalent among adult smokers, cigarette sales have plummeted in Japan. They've plummeted. So that's one example. If you take the example of data from the UK, where vaping is particularly prevalent, cigarette smoking rates have gone down. They've plateaued a little bit now, which indicates that perhaps more can be done to encourage smokers to switch to better alternatives. But I'm not aware of countries where you see prevalence of smoke-free alternatives has caused an increase in smoking. It's the opposite. Sweden is another fantastic example where the prevalence of alternatives is very high. A product called Snus is very prevalent, and smoking rates are among some of the lowest in the world. So again, I would encourage people to look at what's actually happening in the real world. There's a phenomenon called common liability. So people who are more likely to smoke are also more likely to use these alternatives because of all sorts of other factors rather than just the products. So that may play a role. So that's why looking at this real world evidence to see what's happening in the world in places where these products are prevalent, and it does not indicate that there's a gateway effect. In fact, it indicates that these products may be a gateway out of smoking rather than into smoking.
And yet I saw a study yesterday about smoking among middle-class women in England up by 25%. Is that linked to vapes and heated tobacco in any way?
I would not imagine so. What it could be linked to is confusion. So we see in the last few years that smokers have become increasingly and worryingly confused as to whether vaping is a better alternative to continuing to smoke. We see that the medical profession is confused. And I think this is something where the media, where we as tobacco companies, where public health people can play a much greater role in ensuring that people like this class of women that these reports have been published in the last few days are very aware about the ongoing dangers of smoking and very aware about the alternatives that exist to them if they're not going to quit. So it's a responsibility of us all to make sure that we're not misinforming people and that they have the right information to guide their choices.
Mm-hmm. So the ongoing dangers, if we're going to talk about those, we need to talk about that sort of more broadly, including heated tobacco products, e-cigarettes, vapes as well, because they do come with risks.
That's correct. I think I mentioned before, none of these products are risk-free. And I think we are very clear with our consumers and very clear with the regulators and policymakers as well, that they're not risk-free. The best option for anybody is never to start smoking. And if they have started smoking, then they should quit. But for those who don't, these products, the evidence shows that these products are a much, much better choice than continuing to smoke. And that's the message that needs to be got across to adults in the United Kingdom.
And one of the risks of these products is that it causes asthma, I believe. PMI, as well as selling products that cause asthma, you also own the pharmaceutical company Vectura, which makes asthma inhalers, I believe. So not only do you make millions off the products which cause asthma, but you also profit off the products which treat it. How would you answer those critics that say this is a massive conflict of interest?
So first of all, I think these critics have not really thought about the long-term strategy of this company. We did not purchase Vectura to access revenues from asthma inhalers. What we purchased Vectura for was to unlock a future revenue stream, which is about products that are nothing to do with smoking, nothing to do with smoking-related diseases.
That's not quite true, is it? It's not that it's not nothing to do with it when the product is solving a condition that is caused by smoking.
So what I'm saying is the strategic interest for us in Vectura was not their current product portfolio. It's what we can do and develop that goes completely away from what the company is currently working on into new avenues. And one avenue we've been looking at, for example, is a product that can help to treat migraines, as an example. So this is about unlocking a future strategy for the company so that ultimately in the long term, we can abandon cigarettes more quickly. So if we have other revenue streams, it helps us then in the transformation. So I think critics have been a little bit short-sighted when they've looked at that acquisition and thought about things in the near term rather than in the long term. I think there's nothing wrong with a tobacco company trying to change their portfolio and mix of revenue streams in order to be able to transition away from cigarettes more quickly.
I mean, you talk about transitioning from away from cigarettes more quickly, but why don't you just stop selling them now?
So that's a question I get often. If you think about it logically, if Philip Morris International stopped selling cigarettes in the United Kingdom, first of all, we have a very small market share in the United Kingdom. But if we did, smokers wouldn't just stop smoking because our brands weren't available. What they would do is go and seek out a brand from a competitor, and our competitors would gladly fulfill that demand. So us unilaterally stopping selling cigarettes does nothing to solve the problem with smoking. What we decided to do was to do a managed transition whereby we could vary the amount of investment we had in smoke-free products compared to combustible cigarettes over time to increase the share of smoke-free alternatives and reduce the share of combustible cigarettes. And I think we've actually done a really impressive job of this because the first products, as I mentioned, came on the market only in a couple of countries in 2014-2015 timeframe. And now they make up 36% of our net revenues last year. And I think that's incredible progress. And we've been able to do that by diverting resources away from combustible cigarettes into smoke-free alternatives. So 99% of our R&D spend is now going on smoke-free alternatives. If we just decided to stop selling cigarettes in a country somewhere, first of all, our shareholders would sack our CEO, number one, because that's a destruction of shareholder value. And number two, our competitors would simply just take up the slack.
Compostable tobacco, it's still big business for you though, isn't it? I'm looking at your latest company report that says in 2023, PMI shipped 613 billion cigarettes versus 125 billion heated tobacco units. So it's true that that's a year-on-year increase of nearly 15% for your heated tobacco products, but cigarettes are down just 1.4%. Aren't you just adding new tobacco products to the market rather than reducing cigarette use?
Not at all, because you have to look back in history. That's just one year's report. In countries where smoke-free products are available, the reduction in cigarette sales is increased compared with countries where they are not available. So some countries, we're simply unable to put our heated tobacco products on the market. If you take Turkey, if you take India, if you take Australia, it's simply legally not possible to put the products on the market. So there we have no alternative than to sell cigarettes. And consumers, unfortunately, have no alternative other than to continue smoking cigarettes as well. So this is where we're urging governments to look at their policies and say, actually, are we doing the right thing to drive down cigarette sales and drive down smoking for our citizens?
But PMI retains a total international market share of 23.7% of all cigarettes sold globally, excluding the US and China, if I'm not mistaken, which is actually a small increase on 2022. And for heated tobacco products, the market share is 4.7%. And that's not smoke-free, is it?
That's market share. That's not talking about increasing a market overall. Again, we're a corporation. We have a responsibility to shareholders to be competitive. And we will remain competitive in combustible cigarettes as we manage this transformation through to smoke-free alternatives. But I think, Becky, you have to put this in context. We are the market leader in smoke-free alternatives, and we are driving the transformation of the entire industry away from combustible cigarettes. Our competitors are now all following our lead. They have heated tobacco products as well as vaping products, as well as pouches on the market. And this is a positive thing for adults who smoke around the world. The more choice that they have, the more likely they are to move away from cigarettes. And I think that's what we need to focus on now. What is the policy that governments can put in place that can encourage a rapid transition away from cigarettes?
You mentioned the word choice, but some people would say that it's not particularly a choice when these products are highly addictive.
They have a choice between cigarettes, which are addictive, and these other products, which are also addictive, but come with a fraction of the harmful chemicals along with nicotine. And that's something that I believe very strongly adult smokers deserve to learn about, because they're making choices every single day to buy packets of cigarettes. Why shouldn't they learn about these other products that are available and help them to make it? We need to help them basically to make an informed choice.
That's all we have time for. Moira Gilchrist, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find more of Spotlight's policy reporting in our standalone Spotlight podcast feed, or the New Statesman website. The links are in the show notes. I'm Becky Slack. Thanks for listening.